On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats and check in on the biggest story, hottest story in NBA right now, the Charlotte Hornets and Con Knipple. You won't want to miss all the numbers we're going to share about Buzz City in Charlotte. Also, should Jason Tatum return to the Celtics? What the history says about midseason returns from an Achilles tear? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, we do this every week on Wednesdays here at Yahoo Sports with your man, my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on?
Tom, I am excited. I'm energized. I'm pumped up. I feel like there's kind of like a buzz in the air. Do you feel it? Do you feel the buzz, Tom Haberstroh?
Oh, I feel the buzz here in Buzz City. Let's do this big number. Ooh. This week's big number is 58.4%. That is Con Knipple's field goal percentage on layups when he has Brandon Miller and LaMelo Ball on the floor. Did I say layups, Dan? Because what I meant was three-pointers. Con Knipple is shooting 58% on threes with LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller on the floor this season. That's ridiculous. It's a layup, a literal layup for Con Knipple when he's getting passes from LaMelo Ball, Brandon Miller, or just when he has both of those guys on the floor. His three-point field goal percentage, Dan, goes from 51% with Melo on, 53% with Brandon Miller on, when they're both on the floor. When he's got those backcourt guys on the floor, that shoots up to 58.4%. It is beyond gobsmack how good he is this season as a rookie, but more when we look at the lens through when he's got those guys on the floor, defenses just don't know what to do. And this is the hottest team in the NBA. They're selling out the arena again. I went to the game on Saturday. The Blazers were in town and people were driving in, Dan, from all over the state and even like South Carolina. They're driving in from hours away to catch the Spirit because the Charlotte Hornets are the best team pretty much over the last two plus months. Since January 1st, they have the best net rating in the NBA, even better than the Celtics, the Spurs, the Thunder. They have the number one offense over that time. They have the number six defense over that time, just behind the Boston Celtics. And on Wednesday night, we get the Hornets versus the Celtics. So I know you're up there in Brooklyn, Dan, but are you feeling the buzz? Can you hear the buzz in Charlotte from all the way up there?
It's a little hard to get it through just the people screaming from the street in Brooklyn that I'm used to. That's it, sort of my general avenue vibe. But it's inarguable that it's getting pretty loud with the Hornets. Like, you can, for a little bit there, for a couple of weeks, it was like, oh, kind of a cute story. They're catching a rhythm, or, you know, they've got, you know, the shots are going down. So we'll see what happens when it levels out. But once that gets to 15, 20, 30 games, you know, and they've won 2/3 of their games going back to Christmas, right? Like, this is it's no longer cute. This is a 500 team that has been significantly better than that for almost half the season now. And it's the best the Hornets have played more than a decade, right? Like, and even those teams, like the Steve Clifford, Kemba Walker, you know, Big Al Jefferson, those teams that kind of like, they like grabbed every piece of low-hanging fruit they could and kind of like clung to those advantages for dear life. This feels a little bit more like, no, we're going to create advantages all over the court. And Con Knipple has been at the center of that, right? You know, you're pointing to the way he shoots with those guys on the floor with him, with LaMelo Ball, with Brandon Miller on. It's also that you can get Con Knipple shots in all different sorts of ways. He can pull off the pick and roll as a handler. He can serve as the screener in the pick and roll. I know Charles Lee loves running those kind of two-man actions, guard-guard screening actions, especially late in games, forcing defenses to figure out, do I stick to LaMelo or do I go with a ghosting, popping Con Knipple? Like, who do you leave open? Brandon Miller only increases the danger there because that's a walking 20-point-a-game scorer who is a 37-38% shooter in his own right. So, like, it's a game of whack-a-mole. We talk about that so often with the best offenses. They make you make these difficult decisions, and wherever you put your resources, there's going to be a leak that springs up over here. The Hornets have become one of those sorts of teams, and it feels like it happened overnight. Part of it because Knipple, with the fourth overall pick, comes in and makes that immediate impact as an on-ball player, a movement shooter, an elite, elite shooter in basically every way you can shoot the mm-hmm. basketball. And you pair that with consistent availability from those two top five picks in LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller. And all of a sudden, you've got a level of firepower that, frankly, I mean, the Hornets haven't had since, what, like Zoe and LJ? Like, it's been a long time since there was a legitimate high-octane offense like this in Charlotte. And it's been an awful lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, it was, the vibes were very strong on Saturday. And they're going through like a really good stretch here in the schedule. You know, Washington, Indiana, Chicago. They're beating up on some not great teams, including the Blazers without Denny Avdia and Rob Williams III, who is the NBA's leading three-point shot blocker, which is a crazy stat, but it's true. Against the Charlotte Hornets, that could have been useful because they are like the best three-point shooting team in the NBA for the better part of the year. But let's zero in on Con Knipple real quick. I think he's like a mix between Steph and Klay Thompson, which sounds absurd, but when you consider that he's leading the NBA in three-pointers made as a rookie, like period, he's leading the NBA and he's a rookie, we just haven't seen anything like this before come through the league this quickly, ramping up 212 made threes through 61 games. Dan, here's the list of guys who have made anywhere close to that in their first 61 games in the NBA. Duncan Robinson is second at 164. Con Knipple's 50 a bet ahead of that dude. He had the record, Duncan Robinson, at 164, and Con Knipple is 48 threes ahead of him. He's 25% higher than the record that was set by Duncan Robinson a few years back. Look at the other names on this list. You got Luka Doncic, his first 61 games in the league, he had 150 threes. Donovan Mitchell, 143. They're top five in this category. Con Knipple lapped them like a month ago. Okay? So this is a guy that came in, we knew he was a good three-point shooter, but we're talking all-time great start. And just a note, Stephen Curry in his first 61 games had 110 three-pointers made, which means that Con Knipple has 100 more threes than Stephen Curry did in his first 61 games as an NBA player. So this is, Dan, one of those things that I feel like it hasn't been since maybe Wemby, his rookie season, Steph when he was like peak Steph, LeBron in 2013, where it's just like the stats that you rattle off for this guy, Con Knipple, they don't seem real. Like, we thought that we'd seen the best with Steph Curry and we'll never see another Steph Curry again because he just revolutionized the sport. But here you got this dude who wasn't even the number one overall pick, not even the top three pick, who's coming in here and burying threes like they're layups. Again, 58% on threes since he's played with LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller. And it's not like a small sample size, right? He's shooting, I have it right here, 60. All right, so this season, 66 of 113. He's had over 100 three-point attempts with Brandon Miller and LaMelo Ball, and he's shooting 66 of 113. That's where you get the 58%. And if you do the math, that's essentially he's shooting like 95% field goal percentage on those threes when that's he's crazy. Playing with those two guys. So like if you had a guy who was dunking the ball and making like 9 out of 10 dunks, Con Knipple shooting a three is more efficient than a guy dunking 9 times out of 10. That's how good he is. The gravity that LaMelo Ball has on the floor, the gravity that Brandon Miller and Con Knipple, defenses are losing their minds guarding these guys. And you said it, the screener action that they have Con Knipple as the screener has been lethal. And the numbers bear this out. Con Knipple this season is the most efficient role man in the NBA. I'm going to say this again. Con Knipple is the most efficient role man in the NBA among the 41 players who have at least 80 role play, like rolling to the rim scoring plays. He has the highest efficiency on those plays. He's scoring 1.47 points every play in the screening action. Stop. Role man where he's trying to score with a pick and pop or the role man. He gets that floater game too when he gets it in the mid-range from LaMelo Ball. But the other four guys on this list, Dan, it's Jalen Duren at second place at 1.39, Chet Holmgren at 1.33, Nemeas Keita at 1.31, and Karl-Anthony Towns at 1.29. The rest of the guys on this list are like 7-footers, and then it's Con Knipple, who's the most efficient role man in the NBA as a wing guy. So it's just, I don't know, Dan, we've had these times in the NBA where you look at a player and you don't know how to put it in perspective. That's what we're doing right here on this episode. We want to put in perspective what Con Knipple and this Charlotte Hornets team is doing, because, I mean, they're 31-31, 5-game win streak. They're the only team in the NBA this season to have a 5-game win streak with at least 15 points margin of victory in each of those 5 games. Not OKC, not San Antonio. None of these teams have done what the Charlotte Hornets have done recently. And, dude, like, have at it, Dan. What are some of your favorite just like top-down numbers or just thoughts about this Charlotte Hornets team?
Well, the first thing that I have to get it out of my head, because I have like this itch from old-timey internet blogger brain. When you said he's like a mix between Steph and Clay, this is the Nick Stauskas that was promised, right? This is the Sauce Castillo that the world begged for and couldn't come to Sacramento, but now has come to a similarly benighted organization in Charlotte, and the sun has suddenly risen. It's incredible to see. But that idea of, if you have a player with size and that shooting ability and the quickness of the release, like it takes it like a blink of an eye and it's gone. And you combine that with, as you know, you mentioned there's only one Steph, but like the league has obviously, you know, reformed in his wake to where volume is no longer like it's not a bad thing that a guy that can shoot like this jacks him up, right? Like, if anything, you want him taking more 3-point shots because it's going to increase the overall efficiency and effectiveness of your offense, create more opportunities for other people. So that you get the combination of the size and the quickness and the accuracy with the imprimatur to like, yeah, no, there is no such thing as a bad one of these for you. Like, you let this go. You have the ultra green light whenever you get it. You combine that with the context and the opportunity, right? Like, this is not him having to create on the level. You know, you mentioned Luka Doncic as a rookie, Donovan Mitchell as a rookie. Those guys are in situations where it's like, you're the show. You have to, if a shot's going to happen, you're going to create it. And then there's the other side of it, like the Duncan Robinsons, where it's like, you are only here as a finisher. If you dribble, something went wrong. And he's in kind of the middle of that, right? Where he's averaging 19 points a game and he's possessing the ball on total like 2.2 minutes per game. His time per touch is super low for somebody that's scoring at that volume. And I think it's because the situation just has coalesced so nicely where LaMelo Ball can be your number one initiator. Con Knipple gets to be attacking either bent defenses that are already warped by the threat of LaMelo Ball shooting from anywhere on the floor or the threat of him passing. He's going to have to deal with often a third defender, a third, you know, top, you know, number three quality defender, because there's also Brandon Miller over there, right? You combine that with we'll talk about it a little bit later when we get into the little numbers, the adjustment that of introducing a guy like Musa Diabate into the starting lineup, where now you've got a constant, like perpetual motion machine screener, dive man, somebody that's going to suck in the defense on those hard rolls. The space just it opens up. It becomes yawning. There's so much opportunity for him to continue to move around the floor, get himself into advantageous positions, and knowing that LaMelo Ball, one of the, you know, real visionary passers in the NBA, is going to find you. And so like it feels. It's like that old, like, I do so love it when a plan comes together. It feels so rare that we've been able to say that for Charlotte over the years, but the pieces didn't fit really. It didn't feel like it made sense. And then you dropped Con Knipple into what was already there. They didn't make a massive free agent signing. They didn't make a gigantic trade to bring in some other sort of retrofitting piece. He kind of plopped into the middle of what they already had, and everything sort of started to make sense. And the result has been one of the best teams in the NBA for 2+ months now, and a team that I think can reasonably look at itself and say, we're going to be a problem when we get to springtime. Like, if we're able to get up to, you know, a 6th seed, we're able to get into the playoffs proper, you know, we're going to have something to say about it. And I think that's something that's it's been rare to be able to say about the Hornets, and it's a real breath of fresh air in a long time coming.
It's wild. I mean, you look at their point differential, Dan, like when you're talking about they're going to make some noise and they're coming in here with a 31-31 record. Now, they do have the tiebreaker over the Hawks because they've beaten the Hawks, I think, 3 out of the 4 times. They have an outside shot at getting as high as like the 5th seed. You know, they're 4.5 games back of the Toronto Raptors. They have a pretty tough schedule. I think top 10 in strength of schedule going forward. They just beat up, just destroyed the 5 teams in their path over the last 5 games. I think on average, like beat everybody by 22 points or something like that. That's what you want to see from a team that's contending for a title. But this team is 31-31. It's very rare to get a team this good with just a 500 record. But their net rating on the season is top 10, plus 3.5. It's better than the Golden State Warriors, Phoenix Suns, the Lakers, the Clippers, the Miami Heat, the Toronto Raptors. And so you have to grade them not as a 500 team, but a team that is performing at a level that is that of, you know, their Pythagorean record, which is basically what is your record should be given how much you outscore your opponents. They're 37-25 by their Pythagorean win-loss record, 12 games above 500. They basically are the Lakers, but in reverse, right? The Lakers have that record, but they're negative point differential. The Charlotte Hornets have a 500 record, but a net differential. They've been blasting teams all season long. And I don't want to like belittle what they've done over the last 5 games against these cake schedules. They've destroyed the Oklahoma City Thunder. They've beaten the Spurs. They've beaten the Hawks. They've beaten the Nuggets, and a lot of them by double digits. So you can't even point to this as just them taking advantage of a downtrodden Eastern Conference. This is them beating up on everybody. So if I'm Boston, who, by the way, has not faced the Charlotte Hornets until tonight, Wednesday night, they will be facing the Charlotte Hornets for the first time this season of 3 tilts against them. I do think that all these Eastern Conference teams at the top want to have nothing to do with this team in the first round. Like, yes, they are still in the play-in. They're the 9th seed. They got to get out of the play-in in order to make the playoff field. But in a 7-game series, I just don't want to have anything to do with the Charlotte Hornets team that, like we pointed out, great defense over the last 2 months of the season. So another thing on Con Knipple, you mentioned it, that he's not just this guy like Klay Thompson who's getting a lot of these off the catch, right? You want to take a guess who has the best 3-point field goal percentage on pull-up threes off the dribble among the players? I think there's 40 players with at least 100 pull-up threes in the NBA. That's right. It's Con Knipple shooting 47% off the dribble. Yeah. Hey, who among us could have seen that coming? Dan, I feel like the more that he does this, he's only going to get better. And LaMelo and Brandon Miller and Musa Diabate and Miles Bridges, they're all going to benefit from that gravity, that not just off the ball, but off the dribble. When he gets downhill and the driving and the 2-foot jumping that, or landing 2 feet and using 2 feet like Jalen Brunson does, he despises jumping off of 1 foot because he's so fundamentally sound in there like Jalen Brunson. I just feel like, as Michael Jordan, once owner of the Charlotte Hornets, said, the ceiling is the roof, Dan. The ceiling is the roof on Con Knipple. Dan, we've got 3 little numbers about the Charlotte Hornets. We've got a lot of stuff here to talk about the hottest team in the NBA. Facing the Boston Celtics on Wednesday night. We'll talk about the Boston Celtics later in the show regarding Jason Tatum and a potentially imminent return from the Achilles tear. Got more on that coming up. But first, we'll get to your 3 little numbers after the break. But Dan, we've got a couple more things here on the Charlotte Hornets. Con Knipple, just a reminder, is shooting 58% on threes with LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller on the floor this season on over 100 attempts. That's not just like a tiny sample. It's absurd what they're doing. A lot of people are wondering how and why. How is this happening? And Dan, you've got 3 little numbers here to explain what we're seeing, not just with Con Knipple, but others on the Charlotte Hornets. What's your first little number here?
Yeah, first little number this week is 826. That is how many minutes LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller have played together this season. In those minutes, the Hornets are plus 287. That's a net rating of 13.7 points per 100 possessions with an offense that has scored nearly 130 per 100, which would blow away the best offenses in NBA history. Obviously, Con Knipple is a big part of that, but they've also been exceptionally good, even in the minutes where Ball and Miller play without Con Knipple as well. I believe they're plus 7.4 per 100 possessions there with a 120 offensive rating. Mm-hmm. So still, like, Knipple is a huge part of that, but getting Ball and Miller on the floor has been big. So that number, our little number 826, in the previous two full seasons since the Hornets drafted Brandon Miller second overall in 2023, Ball and Miller had shared the floor for just 828 minutes. So just two more minutes over the last 2 years than they've played together just this season. Miller's season last year was cut short by a torn ligament in his right wrist. He's already played more than 400 minutes more than he did last season. Ball has already played in more games this season than he has in any year of his career, except for his sophomore year, which is the one he made the All-Star team. And so, like, at the risk of offering some pretty basic analysis here, I don't want to blow your hair back too much. When you've got two top three picks, when you've got two top three picks that are actually able to be on the floor and play together as much as they have over the last two full seasons, it turns out that the Charlotte Hornets are looking a heck of a lot better when they actually get their talent on the court. Imagine that.
This is one of the reasons why the injury crisis in the NBA is so maddening, is because we don't even know who these teams are because we just never get to see them together. So you said it, the minutes, they've already basically eclipsed the minutes that they've played in their first two seasons already this season. It's March 4th as we're recording this. And so when people are like, what's changed for the Hornets? Well, it's because they have their best players on the floor. For the first time in a long time, those guys are healthy. And when you got those talented, like LaMelo Ball is an elite passer, Brandon Miller, elite scorer, and then you throw in maybe the best three-point shooter we've seen in the NBA since Stephen Clay, it's going to be a symphony of buckets. And I think when you have LaMelo and Brandon Miller just kind of incomplete as a grade for the first two seasons, because they just never were healthy enough. They were always kind of, you know, passing ships in the night, just not able to get a consistent number of games played together. I think their total number of games, if you want to look at it this way too, their total number of games that they had played together in the first two seasons together was 39. Played 39 games together in uniform over two seasons. So 39 games out of 164. That's how many games that they had together.
Wild.
And now they've already had 40 plus in this season. So that's the biggest thing, right? Yes, Con Knipple has been awesome, but just getting these two guys a little older into the league, yes, that helps too. Just getting a little bit more seasoning in the league. But it just comes down to, as it does with so much in the NBA, they're just more available, Dan. I know, earth-shattering.
And in those minutes, they've been like an average defense. And that's like, I know that doesn't sound like particularly exceptional stuff, average, but the Charlotte Hornets have not been out of the bottom 10 in defensive efficiency for damn near a decade. The last 7 years, they've been 20th or worse. And they're on pace to finish 15th in points allowed per possession this season, which would be their best finish since 2015-16, the good old Steve Clifford days. And like that, I mean, a moment to shout out Charles Lee, right? Like, comes from the staffs in Boston, in Milwaukee, came up under Mike Budenholzer. And the general principles, like the underpinnings of this defense, at first we were like, how are they going to create even like an okay defense with the talent on this roster? And if you do the simple stuff, right, that low-hanging fruit we were talking about, if you do that with actual athleticism and positional size, you can be all right. You can get to decent. And so, like, they don't foul. They are a good defensive rebounding team. They get back in transition. They try to limit shots at the rim. They have, like, that kind of analytically inclined shot profile where they want to try to get you into the mid-range. And if they're giving up threes, they want to give them up to certain shooters and not others. Like, they're locked in on their scout. And so we've talked about it before with other teams like Houston in years past, where it's like the quickest way to get from abject to decent is like be all right on defense. And so they did that. And if you're able to do that, keep your stars on the floor, and then the offense elevates, you can really do some things. And that's what we're seeing out of the Charlotte Hornets so far. Our second little number this week.
On that, Dan, on that note, I feel like the NBA, we've done this before with Wemby, where I just feel like they just put Wemby on national TV and flex him in every single time because he's that awesome to watch. Just, sure. He's an alien, right? I feel the same way about the Charlotte Hornets, because they're what Adam Silver wants to happen, is a team that faced with the option to tank and to purposely lose games. They started the season underwater by like 12 games, right? They were like 4-16, 4-14, 11-23 at one point in the season. And they looked at that. They looked themselves in the mirror and they're like, you know what? We're going to go and be the best damn team in the NBA for the rest of the season. It's insane. We should be championing this. We should be praising this. And I think because they play with such a fun brand of basketball with LaMelo Ball and the lobs that he's throwing, the passes that he's throwing, the three-point shot with Colin Knipl, that they had a fork in the road of, we're going to keep trying this. And Charles Lee deserves so much credit for keeping these guys, as Eric Spoelstra loves to say, they did not let go of the rope. Right? They did not let go of the rope. They all started rowing in the same direction, to just torture another analogy here. Rather than tanking, they decided to all turn around and be like, all right, we're not going to go that route. We are going to really try for this thing, and we're going to get some winning out of this organization that hasn't really felt that in a long time. And kudos to Charles Lee, to the organization, Jeff Peterson, for not pulling the plug on the Charlotte Hornets season, because now we have probably the best story of the franchise since they became the Hornets. So, like, got back to being the Hornets. I can feel it, the buzz. And I also felt it during the game. There was a cutaway to Brooklyn Decker and Andy Roddick, who are courtside, Charlottesians, Brooklyn Decker and Andy Roddick, with the Moussa Diabate hat on. They had hats, moose hats on. And I feel like you might have something to say about Moussa Diabate, because I felt like the whole city is saying his name. Sounds like a boo, but it's actually Moose. And I love this guy. What a gem they found in this guy. Tell me about Moussa Diabate.
Yeah, our second little number this week is 679. That is the Charlotte Hornets winning percentage when Moussa Diabate is in the starting lineup this season. He has made 28 starts. The Hornets are 19-9 in them. In those starts, he is averaging 9 points, 9.8 rebounds, 2.3 assists, and 1.6 stocks, steals and blocks combined, in 29.4 minutes per game. He's shooting 68% from the floor, and he is just an absolute whirling dervish to watch. This dude never stops moving. It's screen, it's dive, it's relocate. When he's on defense, he's all over the place. He's switching out onto the perimeter. He's flying in on the glass. He has become one of the best offensive rebounders in the entire NBA. Rebounding 16.7% of his teammates' misses, which is the second highest offensive rebounding rate in the league among qualifying players, behind only Donovan Klingon of the Portland Trailblazers. Guys like Mitchell Robinson, Steven Adams, they have not played enough minutes to qualify, but they would be up there too. But Moussa Diabate is averaging like 29 minutes a game as a starter, so that's why he's up there. Elite efficiency as a role man in the pick and roll, running the floor in transition, which makes him a perfect fit stylistically for this team that wants to get out and run with all their athletes in transition. They generate more second chances, turn the ball over less, create more turnovers, and get out in transition more with him on the floor. And this is a guy who was a pretty lightly regarded second round pick of the Clippers in 2022. He barely played 250 minutes in his first two seasons as a pro. And now he feels absolutely essential to the identity that this team has built. Like, as you said, you know, these guys become fan favorites. They become like totems for their teams. He has developed into that. I mean, the fact that when they go toe-to-toe with the Pistons, it's him right in the mug of Jalen Duren and things get spicy. You don't want to see anybody throw any punches, but like that he's not backing down at all from the big bad bullies on the block. Like, all of this stuff matters. And he has gone from, I think everybody was making jokes. Why did the Hornets trade away like their whole center rotation to the Suns? What happened to all those guys? Turns out they had maybe the best guy in the whole bunch sitting on their bench and nobody outside of Charlotte knew it.
Oh man. I loved when they were freeing up the spot for Moussa Diabate, because he's one of those like low usage, high energy guys. And by the way, like the best rebounding team, best rebounding percentage as a team, the Charlotte Hornets, since January 1, when all this stuff is going on, we can talk about the threes and the transition game and LaMelo Ball and his passing, but Moussa Diabate is the reason why they're number one in rebounding rate over that time. And that doesn't get enough headlines, is that they're just a team that gobbles up rebounds. And he's a big reason why. He's a great cutter, pick and roll guy. And as you said, like when you're going toe to toe, nose to nose with Jalen Duren, and this dates back to his high school days, Musa Diabate and Jalen Duren, they had beef going back to high school. And people don't realize this also about Diabate. He was the 11th ranked high school player coming out and one of the top prospects for a big man in the world, you know, coming out of high school. And so for him to fall to a second round pick and bouncing around the league a little bit, the Charlotte Hornets have definitely found a gem here with Musa Diabate and a fan favorite for sure. It's a great story and it's an unheralded story because he's not a guy that's going to, you know, fill up the scoring column, but he does all the dirty work for you and he's an essential player for a winning team. So you're going to hear a lot more about this dude if they make the playoffs because he is that guy that you need. That rim running roll man who is just so much energy around the basket and runs the floor really well, like you said, that's going to be a huge asset for this team. And I love that you're giving him a shout out here.
Well, another player who he gets shouts out from, I think, a lot of teenagers and young people in the fan votes in All-Star balloting, maybe less so from people like me and you, the media out here, is the subject of our third and final little number this week. Third number is 57.7, which is the Hornets' effective field goal percentage as a team with LaMelo Ball on the floor this season, according to NBA Advanced Stats. That effective field goal percentage would rank number one in the NBA for the full season. And that's kind of interesting because LaMelo Ball as an individual player has a 50.1 effective field goal percentage. Mm. Which is one of the worst marks of any high usage player in the NBA this season. And so we've got this kind of contradiction, this inherent paradox where LaMelo Ball himself, he of the step to the side, one-footed three from 30 feet out, doesn't necessarily profile as an efficient player. But his team and his team's offense is extraordinarily efficient with him on the floor. And I think part of that is, you know, we've talked about it before, effective field goal percentage as if it is a stat that like it adjusts for the fact that threes are worth more than twos, right? And so Who's really good at creating three-point shots? When you look at three-pointer assists to three-pointers per 100 possessions, there's TJ McConnell, number one with a bullet, the god. Number two, Giannis Antetokounmpo, makes sense. Number three is LaMelo Ball. And so Our friend, the guys over at the Hot Hand Theory podcast recently made a really good video about like that dichotomy between LaMelo's individual inefficiency and Charlotte's team efficiency with him on the floor. So I would recommend people go check that out. But it's like he has dealt with all of these slings and arrows and some of it deserved for being like an unserious player. I don't think I've ever heard the word unserious associated with a player more than it's associated with LaMelo Ball. But then you look at his impact. All of our fanciest advanced numbers, the ones that are based on adjusted plus minus and regression analysis of these things, your estimated plus minus, your XRAPM, Darko daily plus minus, LeBron, Synergy SPI, whatever, all of these hoity-toity fancy things. And LaMelo's like 97th, 98th, 99th percentile offensive engine on those, all of those. So like,
He's shooting less than 40% from the floor, right? Like, you're by the historical traditional measures, he is not a good scorer and not an efficient player. And then you have all of these other things saying he's top 1-2% in the NBA as an offensive engine. And it's just, this is why we have these kind of metrics, is to be like, how do we explain this LaMelo Ball effect by a guy who's shooting 39% from the floor? Well, this is it right here.
Absolutely. And there's the points created component of it. Yeah, he's up near the top of the league in terms of assists per 100 possessions and the points that are generated from those. It's the gravity you talked about also too. Like it's a funny thing. Like, yeah, those shots look like circus shots, but if he's going to take them all the time and if he can make them at like a 36% clip from outside, you got to guard him out there. And if you got to guard him out there, he's also 6'7" with like an incredible amount of with incredible vision, and he's going to find your wide open guys all over the place. I know, 6'7", there we go. And so we wind up like the proof comes out in, and it's very funny because I looked at this up, I double checked this to make sure. It comes out in the on-off numbers. And some of that is also like they haven't been quite as good offensively with Trey Mann on the ball as the backup point guard. That's fine, whatever. When you look at the on-court, off-court swing, the Hornets have been 14.1 points per 100 possessions better with LaMelo on the court this year than off it, according to our friends at Cleaning the Glass. That's a bigger swing than any player to play 1,000 minutes in the NBA this season, except for two, Nikola Jokic and Victor Wembanyama.
Dude.
And if that surprises you, you're not alone. That's why I looked it up twice. But that's what we're talking about here. It seems like jokes and silliness, but something really serious is happening when he's actually on the floor for these Hornets. And as much as Con Knipl has made everything kind of make sense, and Brandon Miller deserves a ton of credit for the way he's bounced back from his injury and continued to grow his game, and the drafting of guys like Ryan Kalkbrenner and Cyan James and Charles Lee with the schematic approach that he's taken, like, everybody deserves credit. It kind of all does come back to this guy, though. And as much as he's been joked about and had dealt with the slings and arrows from folks like us, something pretty serious happens when he's on the floor and the Hornets are reaping the benefits of it.
Can you imagine if the Warriors got him instead of James Wiseman?
Oh, come on, man. why are we bringing up old stuff? We got, you know, like, oh, man. But that top three being Ant, Wiseman, LaMelo, and like the Warriors being in the middle.
What's happening? When you have a guy who's Steph and Clay at the same time, and look at how awesome the offense is when you have LaMelo Ball feeding him the rock. And this is the thing for a guy that has been, and I probably am guilty of this, is saying, man, I just don't feel like he has winning habits out there. When has he won? Well, how about this for a stat? Since January 1st, he's number two in the NBA in winning. +308 in the plus minus column, is second in the NBA behind Derek White, champion Derek White of the Boston Celtics. So for a guy who doesn't have a lot of winning habits, he has a habit of winning a lot of his minutes on the floor. +308 yep. is more than Wemby, is more than just about literally every player not named Derek White for the Boston Celtics, which we'll get into in a little bit. But the rehabbing of his image and the reputation that he held just by these last 2 months is awesome. And I don't like driving on roads with LaMelo Ball on the floor, but I can't deny I cannot deny, Dan, that on the floor, the guy is just, he's a great engine for the offense. And the Hornets are awesome with him on the floor. I think, like, when you look at the metrics of when he's on the floor and feeding Con Knipl on those threes, not just on the floor, field goal percentage, 3-point field goal percentage, but directly passes from LaMelo Ball to Con Knipl, Knipl is shooting 53% on threes. So that combination of LaMelo in the high pick and roll where you have to guard him 40 feet in because he's a solid 3-point threat, that like his effective field goal percentage, his points per play on a deep 3-pointer, even if it's off of 1 foot or off of both heels, doesn't matter. Like, you can't give that up. That's like a layup, you know, because of the added value of the 3-point shot. But if you put two on the ball and you got that ghost screen, that little cut from Con Knipl who gets out to the wing, that's devastating. 53% field goal percentage on those threes from LaMelo Ball. So for a guy that doesn't have the greatest reputation as a winning player, it's a whole lot of winning. But we'll see on Wednesday night against the Boston Celtics. We're going to be seeing the two top guys in plus minus over the last couple months, Derek White and LaMelo Ball. I can't wait to see it. And I know the rest of the NBA community, we need to be seeing more of the Charlotte Hornets. They're a great story, a lot of fun, and a city that sold out, had a longer sellout streak in the 90s at the Charlotte Coliseum than any team in the NBA. So we know we have some sleeping Hornet spirit in this town, basketball spirit to support the local team. And now you're seeing it again with Musa Diabate, LaMelo Ball, Charles Lee, and of course, Con Knipl, the greatest shooter since Steph Curry. So Dan, we got to talk about Jason Tatum and a lot of buzz around whether he's going to return this week or not. So I wrote this story for Yahoo Sports. We're going to talk about that coming up after the break. All right, the Boston Celtics are surely very scared of that 58% big number for Con Canipel when he's on the floor with LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller, probably on the top of the scouting report for this game on Wednesday night. A game that we aren't going to have Jason Tatum back quite yet, but there's lots of buzz around whether he's going to return this week. Bill Simmons saying all signs pointing to him returning on Friday, which is going to be an ESPN game. And then there's an ABC game on Sunday with the Boston Celtics. So we'll see whether he is going to suit up and make his triumphant return coming back from his Achilles tear in the playoffs last year. And one thing that I've been tracking here, Dan, is whether Jason Tatum is like ahead of schedule, behind schedule. Do we want him to come back this season? What's the history of Achilles tears coming back in the midseason? And so I wrote this story, this research, this study I did over at Yahoo Sports. Go check it out now for the written column. But I'll give you just kind of the details here is that right now, if Jason Tatum came back, he'd be at approximately 10 months since the Achilles tear in the postseason against the New York Knicks. And his idol, Kobe Bryant, came back, if you remember, in 2013, I think it was, when he came back, it was a lightning quick return. Like, he came back, and if you remember the Facebook video, I don't know, this is probably our blogger brains might have already forgotten this, but I remembered this, and I had to write about it, is like the Lakers put out this 2-minute video of a very dramatic rendering of a jersey fluttering in the wind. And it starts off as there's sunshine, and then suddenly a storm comes through, and there's rain, there's sleet, there's lightning, there's thunder, and chish, like a rip happens on like halfway through the jersey, symbolizing that he tore his Achilles. And then suddenly a beam of light breaks through, and Kobe Bryant's jersey is fluttering in the wind, and suddenly it's whole again. And then it says, like, Kobe Bryant, the legend continues. He's back coming up December 8th against the Sacramento Kings. And I remember seeing that and being like, this is awesome. I just hope he's healthy when he comes back and that they're not rushing it back, that it's not this Hollywood thing that they're just trying to market Kobe Bryant's return. And sure enough, 9 days later, he left with a pretty bad knee injury, and his season was over, and he was never the same after that as a player. So, Dan, 10 months since he came back, 8 months for Kobe Bryant when he came back then. And the note that I want people to remember is that Kevin Durant, the greatest Achilles recovery story of all time, he came back in 18 months. He took the entire season off, and because of COVID, it got pushed back. And if I'm looking at whether I want the Kobe Bryant road back, the return that was quick, but ultimately ended in a lot of just breaking down over the last couple of years of his career. And then Kevin Durant, I know it's easy for me to say, Dan, but I want the Kevin Durant story rather than the Kobe Bryant return story, because I feel like that might be what's best for Jason Tatum coming back midseason. How do you see this situation playing out? Like, I know you're not a Celtics fan, but are you at all nervous about his return coming back if he does this in the next couple of weeks?
I don't know how you couldn't be at least a little bit nervous. You know, I mean, obviously the Celtics and Tatum and their, you know, player health team and, you know, Tatum's doctors, they all have the information at hand that we don't, as far as what the relative strength of his calf and his ankle and his heel and every other, the ligaments and everything, like what the general health looks like. And if it's more leaning into the red or leaning into the green, you'd have to imagine that everybody would throw their bodies in front of it if it was at all a concern, right? That said, you're coming back in like the heat of a playoff race where the Celtics have, I mean, it's been a remarkable season for Boston to get to the second seed in the East without Tatum, to be, you know, by point differential, one of the two or three best teams in the NBA for a large chunk of the season without Tatum. You know, Jaylen Brown with the sort of fringe MVP case that people keep making, and Derek White can, even in a down shooting season, continuing to be one of the highest impact two-way players in the NBA. Like, there's a brilliant stories abound in Boston, and Tatum coming back to add another weapon for a potential title run and what everybody expected would be a gap year. Like, that would be as good a story as any of them, right? I think you would be like, I was there when I was covering Knicks Celtics game 4 when Tatum went down. My assignment very quickly changed from the Knicks are, you know, on the verge of someplace no one thought they could be to the Celtics are on the verge of the unimaginable. And I was there. I was like in the pressers. I was asking Jaylen Brown and Derek White, like, were you able to talk to him? Have you, like, and seeing the 1,000-yard stares on those guys' faces, like knowing what was going to come for them and for the team and for them to have overcome that and get to where they are now is, again, one of the best stories in the NBA this season. And I would imagine that anybody who was there, who saw that, who watched it all happen, has to have at least a little bit of concern about the potential for re-injury. But I also know every report along the way is like, he's stepped up bit by bit by bit, and it's a 5-on-5 scrimmage, and he's a full go, and he's feeling strong. He's looking good. He's the one who gets to call the ball on this. And you have to imagine, especially somebody like as competitive as Tatum is, as decorated as he's been, as much as he's achieved in his life, like he saw an opportunity to win an NBA championship snatched away from him and has had to go through this incredibly grueling process. If he sees an opportunity to come back for a team that really might have a shot and that he can provide, you know, he doesn't have to walk in and be the A number one superstar guy. He can figure out where to fit in alongside Brown and Peyton Pritchard and White and all the rest of these guys and like fill in the blanks along the way and get them to where maybe they are the favorites to come out of the Eastern Conference. Like to have the opportunity to re-seize that rare chance at a championship. Like, I don't know how you'd pass up on that for a competitor like Jason Tatum, but yes, the stakes in terms of the health of the lower limbs and, you know, what comes afterward, like the stakes are awfully high. You just hope everybody's making, you know, clear-eyed decisions in that process.
Well, for sure. And it's different. It's not just that there's 10 months since the injury. It's that he doesn't have a training camp. He doesn't have a ramp-up period that Kevin Durant got when he was coming with the Brooklyn Nets. He decided before the season started in 2019-2020, he's like, I'm taking the year off. Like, I'm not rushing back to the middle of the season. That's before the pandemic hit. Like, he had no knowledge of that pandemic was about to hit. And then it made it easy for him, like, rather than trying to rehab in the bubble in July with the Brooklyn Nets, who went to the bubble, he just was like, yeah, easy call for me. I'm going to just rehab on my own and I'll be ready to come and dominate next season, which he did. He averaged 34 points in the postseason with the Nets. And he was sensational. Like, I don't think we talk about enough how Kevin Durant has recovered from an Achilles tear at age 30. And he's been basically one of the best scorers in the league through age 37, unheard of for a guy snapping his Achilles with all the miles on his tires. And I just feel like the lesson should be keep the long-term view in mind, and that the Boston Celtics, like, if Jason Tatum felt like, I'm not 100% there, but maybe I'll get there in a couple months. But I don't know if the Celtics are going to be there in a couple months, because what if they're a second round out or a first round out? He won't have a chance to return this season. So I can understand why he's like, look, the clock is ticking here, and I want to play for this team and help this team in their championship quest, because maybe we can do this lightning in a bottle. But I also am seeing the data. And one of the things that jumped out to me when I did this study, Dan, is I looked at, with the help of Jeff Stotts over at InStreetClothes.com, there have been 30 Achilles tear recoveries that I've seen since 2005. And what's interesting is in that decade of 2005 to like 2014, the average return to play, it was about 10 months. And so Jason Tatum back then would have been right on the money if he comes back this week. But since then, you've seen guys take a lot longer, about 13 and a half months since the Achilles tear to come back, 3 months later than what we used to see for these Achilles injury timetables. And so if you want to look at it through the lens of, hey, back then, 10 months is what you need. Like, 10-month recovery is just right on the money. But lately, we're seeing a lot of these DeJounte Murrays where it's take a year off, 12 months, 13 months. And if you're coming back at the end of the season, think about doing the Kevin Durant route, or what we're seeing with Tyrese Halliburton and Damian Lillard is like, take the whole season and then come back 100% where you have a training camp, you have a preseason, you can ramp up with the team. And so you're dealing with some of those awkward, like, hey, I know you guys are running the offense this way and all the tweaks and the new additions to the team and personnel and acclimating to that and integrating to that, you get the whole stress-free benefit of just ramping up in a training camp and a preseason. After looking at the data, I'm feeling much better if he just takes the year off and lets this season ride and gets fully 100%. But then again, that's up to the docs. That's up to Jason Tatum. And I'm not them. So who am I to say? But I know talking to my Celtics friends, my dad, my uncle, I was just talking to them this morning, they both kind of feel like, hey, let this team with Jaylen Brown and Derek White and Peyton Pritchard do their thing and come back next year 100%. And I understand that sentiment, but I'm also not Jason Tatum and I'm not the Boston Celtics. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think the fact that Tatum and the Celtics and everybody involved didn't shut this down 6 months ago, 8 months ago, whatever, there was just like, let continue to leave open the possibility. It was because they knew that if they got to this time of year and all systems looked to be go, and Tatum as a relentless competitor was invested in the idea of coming back, and there was something to come back to. Like the difference between, you know, KD in that first Brooklyn year or DeJounte Murray with the Pelicans now, like those teams, they kind of like they're playing out the string. So there was like no pressure for that either. Like KD not coming back that first year, like there was no pressure on that. DeJounte Murray coming back now, there's kind of no pressure on it because it's like he can have the ramp up. It just is what the Pelican season is right now, right? With Tatum, there was the idea of like, these games are going to matter. They're going to be high intensity. There is no buffer zone here. But that's like, if you're Jason Tatum, that's what you're looking for, right? It's the opportunity that you kind of live for. So yeah, I mean, and if the question is, can he find, not necessarily like, does he have to be 1A ahead of Jaylen Brown again? It's, can he provide something that at a certain point in a series, maybe Sam Hauser or Jordan Walsh or Hugo Gonzalez might not be able to? The answer to that very well might be yes, even if Jason Tatum is, you know, 10 months removed from the last time he played competitive basketball. So I get it. I think everybody involved, it's like everybody's got to have the clear eyes of knowing what they're sort of signing up for here. But if he's able to do it, and if he's able to get back on the court, he's able to get ramped up, it makes an already interesting Celtics postseason run like all the more fascinating to keep an eye on.
Yeah. We'll see what happens here. It would be a great story if he comes back and is just awesome. And there have been players who've come back midseason and have played well. It's certainly looking like the data is pointing towards like the KD route being more risk averse, and certainly giving yourself more time in theory makes sense. But we also saw John Wall. He was gone for like 2 years and never really got back to where he was pre-Achilles tear. DeMarcus Cousins took 12 months, 13 months, and just wasn't the same player. So regardless, it might not have anything to do with the layoff time. It might just be, you know, the mechanism of your injury and just the circumstances. It might be out of his control. So whether it comes now or in October, might not make a difference, but it's certainly something to think about with the KD versus Kobe routes. I certainly think it was heroic that Kobe Bryant came back in 8 months, less than 8 months from his Achilles tear, only missed 21 games. But I also look at what happened to KD and how he had this amazing back nine to his career after an Achilles tear. And I kind of feel like that data point also should be considered here. Obviously, Jason Tatum is thinking everything, all the options on the table. But I can't wait for Wednesday night. I'll be doing the Blazers-Grizzlies game. The Memphis Grizzlies, very shorthanded. We'll see if Denny Avdia is going to be playing in this one. But I wanted to point this out before we go, that collectively the bottom 10 teams in the NBA are on a 40-game losing streak. If you string them all together, the losing streaks of the bottom 10 teams in the league, including the Memphis Grizzlies. So, yeah, we'll see what happens on Wednesday night. Dan, big night in the NBA. I'm excited for it. Thanks for this Charlotte Hornets big number, along with this matchup with the Boston Celtics, a very Wednesday night themed episode here. I want to also give a shout out to Sarah and Brad, our producers, Emmy behind the scenes. And Ryan, thank you so much for producing this show and all the great graphics and the highlights. Appreciate this. And go check out our Yahoo NBA YouTube channel, which you can find at Yahoo NBA for the Kevin O'Connor Show, the Dunker Spot. And also check out our Fast Channel, Yahoo Sports Fast Channel, where you can watch us on TV as well. So YouTube, TV, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast, give us a 5-star review. Leave us a nice little comment. And as Bomani Jones says, if you do not give us a 5-star review, I am liable to call you a hater. Dan, thanks so much, buddy. We'll talk next week.